grace. 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 Grace.
All right, so here we are. We're starting in through the Bible. This is our last bit on 1 Samuel, chapters 30 and 31. We're going a little further than that tonight because in these chapters, in chapter 31, we have overlap. So we have begun the beginning of our looking at how 2 Samuel and Kings and Chronicles provide overlap with one another. When I get this message tonight on the website, there will be a PDF file that you can download, put it on your phone, tablet, whatever, or just look at whenever you want to, or even print it out, whatever you want, that will provide you a basic idea of where will we be going in the next several months. So you'll see how this passage and this passage and this passage from these various books between 2 Samuel and 2 Chronicles provide overlap. And so you'll kind of have a basic idea where we're heading. That'll at least help some degree, okay? But here in chapter 30 is a story you are pretty familiar with since I've used it many times in illustrations in the past teachings. It is David at Ziklag, which is the land, if you remember last week, Ziklag is the land that the Philistine king gave to David during the time of his exile from Israel while he was running away from Saul. I remember David came to his own conclusion, I need to protect myself. So he ran to this Philistine king, sought refuge, and started fighting wars on their behalf. And and if you remember last week that Philistines were about to declare war on Israel. And the king that David had gotten kind of cushy with of the Philistines had several kings, several leaders. The one he was allied with, was perfectly okay with David going into war against his own people. In fact, he said, you do realize if I go, you need to go. And David said, lead the way. But then when they gathered the day before the actual battle, the other leaders were like, what are these Hebrews doing with us? I don't think so. They're not going to battle with us. And so David was sent back to Ziklag just as they were about to go into battle. So chapter 30 is the story of him going back to Ziklag. So I just wanted to kind of give you the background so you remembered. So 1 Samuel chapter 30, starting in verse 1, says, David and his men arrived at Ziklag on the third day. The Amalekites had raided Negev and attacked and burned down Ziklag. They also had kidnapped the women and everything and everyone in it, from the youngest to the oldest. They had killed no one, but they carried them off as they went on their way. When David and his men arrived in the town, they found it burnt down. Their wives, sons, daughters had all been kidnapped. David and the troops with him wept loudly until they had no more strength left to weep. David's two wives, Ahinoab and the Jezreelite, and Abigail, the widow of Nabal, the Carmelite, had also been kidnapped. So David wasn't spared in this. David was in a difficult position because the troops talked about stoning him, for they were all very bitter over the loss of their sons and daughters, as you can imagine. But David found strength in the Lord his God. Now, stopping right there in verse 6, if you remember, I've actually painted a picture for you in the times in the past of this exact same example of David strengthening himself in the Lord. The example I gave you wasn't original to me. I actually had read it in a book from Malcolm Smith, and it was about how he was giving a word picture of this word, strengthened himself in the Lord. And it is like a two-cord rope, David being one strand and God being the other strand, and being interwoven together, they share the corporate strength of one another. Of course, as we all know, David didn't have a lot to add to this. He's just a human being. His strength is little. God's strength is infinite. But God does not intertwine his strength with nothing. He intertwines it with man. And so David, having little strength, he intertwined himself with the Lord and thus shared in the bounty of God's strength in a time of deep need. So David did not attempt to go it alone. And that's something we see a lot with David. Now, David does make mistakes, some very large ones. nonetheless, we do see in this particular case, when his back was against the wall, the first thought that he had was not to defend himself, not to excuse the situation away and try to justify himself in front of his men. He was broken and he ran to the Lord and he allowed the Lord to be his strength. So what a fantastic example we have in David. Picking up in verse 7, it says, David said to Abiathar, the priest, son of Ahimelech, bring me the ephod. So Abiathar brought it to him, and David asked the Lord, should I pursue these raiders? Will I overtake them? The Lord replied to him, pursue them, for you will certainly overtake them and rescue the people. David and the 600 men who were with him, as far as the Wadi Bezor, went 200 who were to remain behind would stop. They stopped because they were too exhausted to cross the Wadi Bezor. David and 400 of the men continued in pursuit. So it's kind of worded kind of weird, but where it's just saying that in the pursuit of the Amalekites, they stopped at a place where 200 men were just too exhausted with all that had gone on before and now. And David let them stay there, and the remaining 400 went with him in pursuit of the Amalekites. So that's what that was saying. Verse 11 says, they found an Egyptian in the open country and brought him to David. They gave him some bread to eat, some water to drink, and they gave him some of the pressed figs and two clusters of raisins. After he ate, he revived, for he had not eaten any food or drank any water for 3 days and 3 nights. Then David said to him, who do you belong to, and where are you from? I'm an Egyptian, the slave of an Amalekite man, he said. My master abandoned me when I got sick 3 days ago. We raided the south country of the Cherethites, the territory of Judah, and the south country of Caleb, and we burned down Ziklag. David then asked him, will you lead me to these raiders? And he said, swear to me by God that you will not kill me or turn me back over to my master, and I will indeed lead you to them. So he led them, and there were the Amalekites spread out all over the entire area, eating, drinking, and celebrating because of the great amount of plunder that they had taken from the land of the Philistines and the land of Judah. David slaughtered them from twilight until evening of the next day. None of them escaped except for 400 young men who got on camels and fled. David recovered everything the Amalekites had taken. He also rescued his 2 wives. Nothing of theirs was missing, from the youngest to the oldest, including the sons and the daughters of all the plunder the Amalekites had taken. David got everything back. He took all the sheep and cattle, which were driven ahead of their livestock, and the people shouted, this is David's plunder. Now, there's two things I want to point out here. While those words are fresh in my mouth, I'll just go ahead and say, they were talking about all of the cattle and the sheep that he took. They said, the people were saying, that's David's to keep. He led us in victory. And that's important because later on, you're going to see what David in his wisdom as a king, he's not a king now, but he will be when he becomes king. What he does with that plunder is very wise. The next thing I wanted to point out to you is that this is all the Amalekites. If Saul had done what Saul had been told to do, which is what caused this whole problem in the first place. Remember, Samuel had told him, go, and God has given you a commission to go out and just destroy the Amalekites. And it was during that very battle that Saul not only didn't kill everybody, but he brought back the king and he brought back all that stuff. And that's what caused the judgment that God had placed upon him. And as we're going to read tonight, it is the very reason why God ultimately killed Saul and turned the kingdom over to David, was because of his disobedience to the command of God. And so none of these things would have happened. The whole thing at Ziklag wouldn't have happened. This rescue would not have been necessary. And all this plunder that David had to wind up doing something wise with later also would not have happened if Saul had just done what he was told to do in the first place. So one big lesson that you can learn immediately is that you do not sin unto yourself. What you do affects everyone else, period. And all the more so if you're a person who has authority. And every human being has some authority, whether it is just within your own family, whether it is in work, whether or not it is political or religious or whatever, everybody has some amount of authority. And everyone underneath your authority will either be blessed or suffer based on your decisions, whether they are good or whether they are evil. So it's a big deal. Now, picking up with verse 21, we're going to read about how, though David is not yet a king, David is already establishing good laws. Starting in verse 21, when David came to the 200 men who had been too exhausted to go with them and had been left at the Wadi Bazor, they came out to meet him and to meet the troops with him. When David approached the men, he greeted them. But all the worthless men among those who had gone with David retorted, "Because they did not go with us, we will not give any of the plunder we received to them except for each man's wife and children." In other words, we'll return their children, their family to them, but all the goods that we plundered, they're not going to get because they didn't come with us. Now, I want you to notice that the Bible calls these people, though these were mighty warriors, he called them worthless men because of their heart, the kind of terrible thought that was in their heart. Because one thing that we have seen from the beginning is that God has made it very clear that that his people are one people. And if they get into defeat, everybody is defeated. If they get into victory, everyone rejoices. No one is left out. And David remembers this, because this is what we're about to read turns into a law when David becomes king, but it really kind of was already a religious law, if you will, of Judaism, because God had already said something very similar to this in books we've already read when they were going through the wilderness. But anyway, David said, "My brothers, you must not do this with what the Lord has given us. He protected us and handed over to us the raiders who came against us. Who can agree to your proposal?" In other words, he's pointing it out and saying, you know what, your thoughts are not only selfish and ungodly, yeah, but who could possibly agree with it? It's insanity. He says, "My brothers, you must not do this with what the Lord has given us. I also want you to notice how one thing we've seen over and over with David is that, you know, starting way back with the first raids that he did when he was brought underneath into Saul's house, that David killed his tens of thousands and Saul killed his thousands. In other words, David was a mighty warrior. And you know, people had come to the point where they sang his praises. And I mean, and not only in Israel, if you remember last week when we were reading, the Philistines, the same guys I just reminded you of, the other leaders in the Philistine armies, said, you know, "I don't want David to come with us because he might turn on us in battle in favor of his own people." They said out their mouths, "Is this not the same guy who serves Saul, about whom they sing the songs that Saul has killed his thousands, but David his tens of thousands?" So that his reputation had not only become a national reputation, but an international reputation. So all that to say that if there was a man who could have been lifted up in pride, David was. And yet, in the statement, the first thing that you hear David saying, other than a reprimand to the hearts of these people, was, "God's the one that gave us the victory." He doesn't take credit for himself. Let's read it one more time, starting verse 23. "But David said, 'My brothers, you must not do this with what the Lord has given to us. He protected us. He handed over to us the raiders who came against us. Who could possibly agree with your proposal? The share of the one who goes into battle is to be the same as the share of the one who remains with the supplies. They will share equally. And it has been so from that day forward. David established this policy as a law and an ordinance for Israel, and it continues to this very day." Verse 26. "When David came to Ziklag, he sent some of the plunderer to his friends, the elders of Judah, saying, 'Here is a gift for you from the plunder of the Lord's enemies.' He sent gifts to those in Bethel and Ramoth in the Negev and in Jatir, to those in Aror, in Sifmoth and in Ashtaroma, to those in Raqqa, in the towns of the Jerahmeelites, that's really hard to say, and the towns of the Kenites, to those in Hormah, in Borashan, and in Athach, to those in Hebron, and to those in all the places where David and his men had roamed. Listen to that. In other words, what he did was he sent gifts first, remembering his own people back to Judah. But then after that, it says he wound up giving to all these other places that at one time or another had housed him and provided some form of safety, regardless of how fleeting, while he was running for his life from Saul. So he was making a deposit back into these people, returning the kindness to them. He didn't forget. And that is a big thing about David. David, I'm telling you, was a very good man, especially when what you had to compare him with were such people of low repute. David was a wonderful, wonderful example. So now with the death of Saul is where we begin to see overlap. So we're going to read this chapter, the next chapter, chapter 31, but then we're going to continue on through 2 Samuel chapter 1, and then we're going to also go to 1 Chronicles, and which all give the account of Samuel's death. And that's in the last one is in 1 Chronicles chapter 10. Now, on the website, again, like I said, you're going to find a list as a downloadable PDF file, which will serve as a tentative outline for how we will cover the remaining books of 2 Samuel through 2 Chronicles. It highlights, for the most part, the areas where there is some sort of significant overlap. Now, before we read about the death of Saul, let me explain a little bit about the hows and whys of these books and the way they retell the same stories. As it is often true, we have to approach the scriptures, especially the Old Testament, with a view to the people it was written to and recorded by, and that were Hebrews. They were Hebrew people. They think differently than we do. In many respects, theirs was a practical and more holistic view of their history, and the way it was recorded and arranged in order from beginning to end served a real and practical purpose. The way they ordered the books of the Old Testament is different than the way you and I have ours ordered in our Bible. So, and the differences kind of speak to the way they think. And it's a logical thing. It makes a lot of sense to do it the way they did it. In many respects, there served the practical purpose of outlining history from a perspective of having been lived through it and ancestors who had lived through it. It might also prove helpful to know that the term Old Testament is literally actually not even a biblical word. I understand that if you were to turn to 2 Corinthians 3:14 in the King James and the New King James and other translations, it actually uses the word Old Testament. But that was just, they were employing terminology that actually hadn't come around for several centuries, okay? At least a century and a half. The word Old Testament did not exist during the time of Paul or anybody else at that time. In fact, the word Old Testament was in that verse, in 2 Corinthians 3:14, literally, if you translate it literally, it just means the Ancient Testament. That's how it would be literally translated. The phrase Old Testament was coined by a guy named Melito of Sardis in about 170 AD. So it was at least 70 years after the death of Paul, probably much more than that. And he coined that term to distinguish this part of the Bible from the writings that were eventually recognized as the New Testament. So that word doesn't exist anywhere but in modern thought. Now, the Jewish Bible is arranged into three main sections, and this is all going to be on the website, so you can take some notes if you want to, but really just try to pay attention, and you'll see it on the website in written form, and it'll be easier for you to follow there, okay? But the Jewish Bible is arranged into three main sections. They're called the teachings, the prophets, and the writings. Now, the teachings are what you and I most commonly call the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible. The prophets included a whole subset of books. I'm going to get more specific into that in a minute. And then the writings were mostly like poetic and so on. The Jewish people call this collection of books the Tanakh. That's T-A-N-A-K-H, the Tanakh. The word Tanakh is actually derived from the first letter of the three names of the three divisions of Scripture in the Hebrew Bible. It's very practical. So these are further divided into other categories. So the teachings, which is the first section of the Bible or the Pentateuch, they include Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. The prophets are further divided into three sections, and that is the former prophets, the latter prophets, and then the 12 minor prophets. The former prophets include information about major personalities like Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings. The latter prophets, which work to exhort Israel to return back to God, include the books of Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel. The other 12 minor prophets are Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk, Zephaniah, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. All of that on the website. Don't worry about writing it down now. So that's the division of the prophets inside of their Bible. And then the writings are divided into three categories as well: poetry, theology, and drama. These include the Psalms, Proverbs, Job, Song of Solomon, Ruth, Lamentations, Ecclesiastes, Esther, Daniel. Ezra and Nehemiah are actually one book, not two books. And then finally, Chronicles, where you and I have Chronicles after Kings. Chronicles is the last book of their Bible. And there's a reason for it. Their divisions make sense if you're looking at it from a Hebrew mind. Regarding the last three, there is no official order that the Daniel, Ezra, Nehemiah, and Chronicles, there's no official order for them. But they share the same category because they all describe later events in Hebrew history prior to the Maccabean period. Now, I know I'm already shooting slap over your head. The Maccabean period, even though I've taught on it probably a half dozen times over the years, I don't expect you to remember it. The Maccabean period, essentially, it's actually broader than this, but Israel, essentially, you remember all the way through our writings so far and the readings we've done so far, Israel many times just ticked God off and he wanted to wipe him off the planet. And he called someone like Moses or Aaron or Joshua to intercede on their behalf. Well, eventually, God gets so fed up with his people that God lapses into literally a 400-year silence where he doesn't say anything to anyone. 400 years of pure silence. And it is in the middle, at the end of that silence, is when Jesus was born. And so it was a time of great anticipation, longing for and waiting to hear the voice of God. And this is why what you read, some passages might begin to make some sense now when you're reading the New Testament. The Bible talks about in Hebrews, first chapter, it says, God who in sundry ways and in various times in the past spoke to us by the prophets has in these last days spoken to us by his son. Well, the Hebrew mind sees there were the prophets, then 400 years of silence, and then Jesus came. You and I read that, and we're like, we forget about the 400 years because we didn't experience it. So, but you need to understand that Maccabean period is a big deal. It was during that time period that there was a guerrilla warfare in Israel, and a whole group of people, Peter, by the way, was one of them. At least we suspect that he was. Decided to wage war against Rome, and that's why Peter always had a sword with him, which is why he had one handy to cut off the high priest guy's ear when they came to arrest Jesus, and Jesus addressed the issue. So, you know, it was during that time period. It was the end of that time period. So I just say that so that you understand that it's during Maccabean time period. As such, they were the last books written, Daniel and Ezra, are the only two in the Jewish scriptures that have large sections originally written in Aramaic rather than Hebrew, and that's because they were written very, very late. So you've got Daniel, Ezra, Nehemiah, and Chronicles were all the very last books written in the Hebrew Bible. And the literature, what's covered in it, is unique to the rest of the Old Testament. That's why Chronicles is different. Even though we look at them, there's a lot of overlap, but it's a different book, very different. The Old Testament scriptures in modern Christian Bibles that you and I sport have more than the 24 books of the Jewish Bible for a reason in the Old Testament. First of all, Christians divided some of the original texts into two or more parts. Like with the Hebrew Bible, Samuel is all one book. There is no first and second. Kings is all one book, no first and second. Chronicles is all one book, no first and second. Ezra and Nehemiah are one book. They're not two books. And the 12 books that I read, told you, are the minor prophets. Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk, Zephaniah, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi are all one book to them. It's called the minor prophets. That's the name of that book. It covers 12 prophets. We divide them into 12 books. So our Bible it reads the same, but it's laid out radically different. In the end, they're identical except the order that they're arranged in. Now, the reason why the books of Samuel and Kings are separated from the book of Chronicles is pretty straightforward. The books of Samuel and Kings versus Chronicles they record an overlapping period of history. They both provide the history of the kings of Judah, describe their reigns, and encourage the people to remain faithful to God. Both highlight David as being a special ruler and the standard by which other kings would later be measured. Samuel and Kings, however, deal largely with the beginnings of a divided kingdom. You see, early on, and we're about to get to this point right now where we're going to see it, Saul is really about the only guy that ruled over all of Israel, and David to some degree. But after that, Israel became divided into two kingdoms. It's all one big Israel, but it had two kingdoms. The southern kingdom was Judah. The northern kingdom was the rest of Israel. And these two divisions even had their own independent kings. So there was the king of the northern kingdom, and then the king of the rest of Judah. The books of Samuel and King address these two kingdoms and reveal the troubles and internal struggles of these kingdoms and their kings. Chronicles, on the other hand, is recorded very, very late in Israel history and is not recording current events, but is looking back on that time period of struggle and initial division and exiles in a type of reflection. Chronicles is largely, in large part, interested only in Judah. In fact, the rest of Israel is only mentioned to the degree that they had an immediate impact on events within Judah. Also, when Chronicles was written, the Jews were trying to recover and reestablish themselves. And so recounting their failures that are recorded largely in Samuel and in Kings would have served no purpose. So when we read some of the same accounts in Chronicles that we do in Samuel and Kings, a lot of the sinful past is cleared up or not even mentioned. Much like what happens in Hebrews 11. If you remember Hebrews 11, it talks about, that's the Hall of Faith, and it talks about, Noah and Moses and Sarah and all these people who went before us and obtained a good testimony by faith. And as you're reading through that, you don't read through any of the dumb things they did. You just read about their successes. Well, that's kind of what Chronicles is to Samuel and Kings. It recaps these things, but it leaves out a lot of the details of how bad things went. It wasn't done to skew history, because Chronicles was not meant to replace these two, but to augment them, to look back on that history with a different lens. And so the Jewish people kind of needed encouragement and strengthening. So re-examining their history through a different lens is what Chronicles supplies. So hopefully that gives you an idea of the overlap and why it exists that way. So now we're going to pick up in 1 Samuel chapter 31, and then we're going to read the other ones before we close, okay? So in chapter 31 in Samuel, it's talking about the death of Saul. Starting in verse 1, it says, "The Philistines fought against Israel, and Israel's men fled from them. Many were killed on Mount Gilboa. The Philistines overtook Saul and his sons and killed his sons, Jonathan, Abinadab, and Malchishua. When the battle intensified against Saul, the archers caught up with him and severely wounded him. Then Saul said to his armor bearer, 'Draw your sword and run me through with it, or these uncircumcised men will come and run me through and torture me.' But his armor bearer would not do it because he was terrified. Then Saul took his sword and fell on it. And when his armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell on his own sword and died with him." Now notice what it says there. It's very clear that Saul took his own life. He fell on a sword, and his armor bearer did not kill himself until he confirmed that Saul was dead. That's important for what we're going to read later, okay? Verse 6, "So on that day, Saul died together with his three sons, his armor bearer, and all his men. When the men of Israel on the other side of the valley and on the other side of the Jordan saw that Israel's men had run away and that Saul and his sons were dead, they abandoned the cities and fled. So the Philistines came and settled in them. The next day, when the Philistines came to strip the slain, they found Saul and his three sons dead on Mount Gilboa. They cut off Saul's head, stripped off his armor, and sent messengers throughout the land of the Philistines to spread the good news in the temple of their idols and among the people. Then they put his armor in the temple of the Ashtaroths and hung his body on the wall at Bethshan. When the residents of Jabesh-Gilead heard what the Philistines had done to Saul, all their brave men set out, journeyed all night, and retrieved the body of Saul and the bodies of his sons from the wall of Bashan. When they arrived at Jabesh, they burned the bodies there. Afterward, they took their bones and buried them under the tamarisk tree in Jabesh and fasted 7 days." Now, let's go ahead and turn now to 1 Chronicles chapter 10, and we'll read the same basic account. And it's almost word for word, but it adds something important. 1 Chronicles chapter 10, it's the whole chapter, verse 1 through 14, says, "The Philistines fought against Israel, and Israel's men fled from them and were killed on Mount Gilboa. The Philistines pursued Saul and his sons and killed Saul's sons, Jonathan, Abinadab, and Malchishua. When the battle intensified against Saul, the archers found him and severely wounded him. Then Saul said to his armor bearer, 'Draw your sword and run me through with it, or these uncircumcised men will come and torture me.' But his armor bearer wouldn't do it because he was terrified. Then Saul took his sword and fell on it. When his armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell on his own sword and died. So Saul and his three sons died, his whole house died together. When all the men of Israel in the valley saw that the army had run away and that Saul and his sons were dead, they abandoned their cities and fled. So the Philistines came and settled in them. The next day, when the Philistines came to strip the slain, they found Saul and his sons dead on Mount Gilboa. They stripped Saul and cut off his head, took his armor, and sent messages throughout the land of the Philistines to spread the good news to their idols and their people. Then they put his armor in the temple of their gods and hung his skull in the temple of Dagon." So that's a little bit of an additional thing. We didn't know that they hung his skull someplace. "When all the Jabesh-Gilead heard of everything that the Philistines had done to Saul, all their brave men set out and retrieved the body of Saul and the bodies of his sons and brought them to Jabesh. They buried their bones under the oak tree in Jabesh and fasted 7 days. Saul died for his unfaithfulness to the Lord because he did not keep the Lord's word. He even consulted a medium for guidance, but he did not inquire of the Lord. So the Lord put him to death and turned the kingdom over to David, son of Jesse." Now that 13th to 14th verse is interesting because if you remember, at least from a natural standpoint, Saul did inquire of the Lord. Remember, he called the priest and he called upon the Urim to get an answer from the Lord. So what's it talking about there? Well, it doesn't mean in that last event where he wound up consulting a medium for guidance, but throughout Saul's life, even though he did many times consult the Lord for guidance, there are several times he did not act on the guidance that God gave him. And so from God's perspective, it was as if he didn't bother asking at all. So again, you have to see this more from a Jewish perspective than from a Greek-minded person. David sets himself, now we're going to go ahead and go back now to 2 Samuel chapter 1, and we're going to read the same account, but we're going to pick up where it left off in 1 Samuel, and that's where we're going to end, is in 2 Samuel chapter 1. It's in 2 Samuel chapter 1, and David sets himself apart now as a good and godly leader by mourning even the death of his enemy Saul. We're going to read that there in 2 Samuel chapter 1. Starting with verse 1, it says, "After the death of Saul, David returned from defeating the Amalekites and stayed at Ziklag 2 days. On the third day, a man with torn clothes and dust on his head came from Saul's camp. When he came to David, he fell on the ground and paid homage. David asked him, 'Where have you come from?' And he replied to him, 'I've escaped from the Israelite camp.' 'What was the outcome? Tell me,' David asked him. 'The troops fled from the battle,' he answered. 'Many of the troops have fallen and are dead. Also Saul and his son Jonathan are dead.' David asked the young man who had brought him the report, 'How do you know that Saul and his son Jonathan are dead?' 'I happened to be on Mount Gilboa,' he replied, 'and there was Saul leaning on his spear. At that very moment, the chariots and the cavalry were closing in on him. When he turned around and saw me, he called out to me, so I answered, "I'm at your service." And he asked me, 'Who are you?" And I told him, "I'm an Amalekite." Then he begged me, "Stand over me and kill me, for I am mortally wounded, but my life still lingers." So I stood over him and killed him, because I knew that after he had fallen, he couldn't survive anyway. I took the crown that was on his head and the armband that was on his arm, and I brought them here to my lord." Then David took hold of his clothes and tore them, and all the men with him did the same. They mourned, wept, and fasted until evening for those who had died by the sword, for Saul, for his son Jonathan, and the Lord's people and the house of Israel. David inquired of the young man who had brought him the report, "Where are you from?" "I'm the son of a foreigner," he said. "I'm an Amalekite." David questioned him, "How is it that you are not afraid to lift your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed?" Then David summoned one of his servants and said, "Come here and kill him." The servant struck him, and he died. For David had said to the Amalekite, "Your blood is on your own head, because your own mouth has testified against you, saying that I myself have killed the Lord's anointed." David sang the following lament for Saul and his son Jonathan, and he ordered that the Judites be taught the song of the bow. It is written in the book of Jashir. And it starts in verse 19 and it reads through verse 27. It says, "The splendor of Israel lies slain on your heights. How the mighty have fallen. Do not tell it in Gath. Don't announce it in the streets of Ashkelon, or the daughters of the Philistines will rejoice, and the daughters of the uncircumcised will gloat. Mountains of Gilboa, let no dew or rain be on you, or fields of offerings. For there the shield of the mighty was defiled, the shield of Saul no longer anointed with oil. Jonathan's bow never retreated. Saul's sword never returned unstained from the blood of the slain, from the bodies of the mighty. Saul and Jonathan loved and delightful. They were not parted in life nor in death. They were swifter than eagles and stronger than lions. Daughters of Israel, weep for Saul, who clothed you in scarlet with luxurious things, who decked your garments with gold ornaments. How the mighty have fallen in the thick of battle. Jonathan lies slain on your heights. I grieve for you, Jonathan, my brother. You were such a friend to me. Your love was more wonderful than the love of a woman for me. How the mighty have fallen, and the weapons of war have perished." So David here begins his reign with a lament over the loss of Israel king and his personal enemy. We know that Saul actually died by his own hand, but this young Amalekite was seeking to ingratiate himself to David, who he knew would be Saul's successor. It's interesting that this young man, again, as I mentioned earlier, would not have even been alive to tell this lie to David if Saul had done what he'd been told to do and to destroy all the Amalekites in the first place, which he failed to do. So this guy that was killed by David should have already been dead anyway. And so justice caught up with him, not only for the fact that he should have been dead already, but also because of his lie. He didn't actually kill Saul, but he lied about it in seeking to ingratiate himself to a foreign king and wound up dying for his lie. So that's all I'm going to cover tonight. I'm hoping that you can begin to see the overlap. And again, Chronicles didn't add a lot to it this time. It does in other places. Other places it actually omits quite a bit. An example of that will be when we get to the sin of David with Bathsheba. It mentions it, but it kind of grazes over the details. Because, again, not because Chronicles is trying to misrepresent, but that's not the point and the focus of Chronicles. Chronicles is trying to reinstill inside of Israel faith in their God and in the leaders that God anoints. And that's not easy to do when all you're doing up is bringing up all the bad things they did. So it's mostly there to reunite their heart with the God of Israel and their leaders. And so Chronicles is going to read a little different. And again, it's important to recognize that Chronicles is the book that ends the Old Testament for the Hebrews. For you and I, it's right in there with Samuel and Kings. And so a lot of people, if they read the books of Samuel and Kings and got to Chronicles, they're like, you know, why are we going back over the same thing all over again? Well, I think now, hopefully, you can understand why it was recorded. It was recorded many, 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 many years after the events had already taken place, whereas Samuel and Kings were written pretty much in tandem with the events themselves. And the purpose of all those books is radically different. So now I'm going to open it up to anybody who has any questions or thoughts about what we've covered tonight.
Mark?
Yes, ma'am.
They were rewriting the history.
No, of course not. I mean, rewriting in terms of re-recording it, but not changing it, not altering it. Like I said, Chronicles deliberately left some things out, but also added certain things. Not added as in things that were not known to be true, but things that were of particular importance to Israel at the time the Chronicles was recorded. Okay? So, like, one of the examples is what we were just reading earlier. In Chronicles, it mentions the fact that Saul died because of his unfaithfulness to the Lord, because he didn't keep the Lord's word, and he consulted a medium for guidance. Well, that wasn't written in the end of the account in Samuel. But do we know that those words are true? Yes, we do, because it was recorded in the body of the book of Samuel that those events did take place. But what Samuel does not tell us is that that is why Saul died. Are you following? So Chronicles doesn't really add to the text, doesn't add to the overall book, but it draws conclusions that causes people to understand why certain things happened that did happen, that Samuel and Kings did not mention. So are you following? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Are you sure?
Himself.
Yes, he did. There's not in essence to it. It was the truth. Like I said, this young Amalekite who came to David lied. He was hoping to ingratiate himself to David because he knew that Saul had pursued David. And so David and Saul were enemies. So he came and told a lie to David and brought David the king and the badge of Saul, hoping that it would ingratiate himself to this king, David. But instead, it got a totally different reaction from David. Are you following or no?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I understand that part.
Okay.
I understand that part. But it I can't remember the exact words, but it was stated that Saul died because of his disobedience to the Lord.
That's right.
So, in other words, he knew that. And he...
Yes. Without question. It would have been an understood thing all the way through Israel, because it was very clear by the words of Samuel, both directly to Saul, and then even when he consulted the medium, that if you remember last week, and you may want to go back and reread that when he consulted the witch at Endor and received those words, whether it was Samuel or not, that appeared to him, by the one that was conjuring him, one way or the other, the words that Saul heard were, "Why are you consulting me? God has turned against you, and he has intended that you will die in the battle because you did not obey him." So the words are right there in the book of Samuel. It's not like the writer of the book of Chronicles had to figure this out. It was written in Samuel. It's just that at the end of the book of 1 Samuel, it doesn't end with the book end that said the reason why Saul died was because of his unfaithfulness and because he didn't keep the Lord's word and because he consulted a medium for guidance. It doesn't end with those words. But we already know that's true because those words were essentially written already earlier in the book of 1 Samuel.
Are you following? It's not really relevant necessarily that Saul killed himself.
No, there's not any relevance to him killing himself other than the fact that it's a matter of history. And it gives us clarity as to what happened with this young man that was an Amalekite coming to David. He was telling a lie. But Saul fell on his own sword and killed himself. Absolutely. Now, he would have died one way or the other. He just wanted to speed the thing up because he knew if the Philistines caught up to him before he completely died, they would torture him. And he did not want that to happen. He knew he was mortally wounded. There was no healing. So Saul just hastened his death by falling on his own sword.
Okay, I get it.
Okay, does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, it does.
Good. Does anybody else have a question or a thought? No?
I'm sort of going back trying to... The armor bearer did not, he said he wasn't going to kill Saul.
That's correct. And he didn't.
For he feared greatly. Was he afraid because of the fact that he knew he was anointed?
It doesn't say. That's a good question, but I can't answer it. I would imagine that he was afraid to kill the Lord's anointed as well. And beyond that, this was his king. And we can't divorce ourselves of the human element here. As best as possible for us, try to put ourselves in the same scenario. This was a man who was sworn to protect Saul. And he himself knew he was going to die. There's no question about it, because the same people were coming to kill Saul were going to kill his armor bearer. There was no escape. And his king, who he was supposed to protect and to bear his armor for him, is here dying and is asking him to run him through. The man is a nervous wreck, and he knows death is literally minutes away. What am I going to do? And so, I imagine in a situation like that, you're not always going to necessarily think the clearest in the world. But I think that he was afraid to do it for multiple reasons. Number one, he had been trained to essentially be the secret service for Saul.
Right.
And now he's being asked to kill the very man that he was sworn to protect. And that went against everything in him. And I imagine that he did not become our armor bearer lightly. Saul was a paranoid man and a prideful man. So I imagine that he picked the one guy in the kingdom that he knew, this guy will die before he lets me die. So that's kind of character this man probably had. So that's another reason why he probably was terrified to do it. I just can't do it. And that's also another reason why he probably decided it was a matter of honor to die with his lord, with his king. As well as protecting himself, because the truth of the matter is the Philistines probably would have tortured him as well. But to answer specifically, obviously I can't give anything concrete because it doesn't say, but I imagine that you're right. I think that to some degree, part of it was a respect for the position that he had been placed in by God, but also because he's the kind of man that would have been put in a position to protect Saul. And so it ran contrary to everything in him to kill him. So that would be my answer. Whether it's a good one or not, I don't know. So
I'll accept it.
All right. So if there's not anything else, then we'll go ahead and close in prayer. And like I said, I will list on this one right here that we cover tonight at the top of the webpage, there'll be a PDF file that you can download or just reference whenever you want to, print out, whatever you want to do, that gives you a basic idea of how we're going to proceed. It's not always going to be exactly like that, but it'll at least, you know, give you an idea because of how these books overlap with one another. So, all right, let's go ahead and close.
Grace. 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 Grace.